Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:49, and that is Pacific Standard Time. Summertime. And today being Friday, it's a big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. But first, if we have a review of what happened this week, then the majority of markets were quite weak. Then, when we take a little bit of a more granular look, a lot of it had to do with where we are in the earnings cycle. And then, you know, earnings have generally not been on par, but have disappointed by and large. And of course, there have been a number of high profile exceptions to that, not least Facebook and Amazon. But then when you look at some of the other very big constituents on the S&P, for example, Google has been pulling back. Then Apple had its first lower earnings in the better part of a decade. Then you look at Microsoft has been pulling back rather sharply. So then there's more than countermanded the positive surprises that we've had. So that throws a focus of attention back onto what is it exactly that is driving the bull market here. And there are a number of factors that one has to consider, and perhaps the most bullish is that buybacks are still on track, that companies are still buying back a lot of their shares, and that has been one of the most important enablers for the market to continue to move higher over the last 6 or 7 years. But the ability of that to continue to have a positive effect is based on two different things. The first is that as prices go up, you can buy fewer of your shares with the same amount of money. So the amount of money allocated to additional share buybacks has to increase if it's going to have the same impact. And anyone sitting on the sidelines, even just as a rational third party looking at it, and would have to say that why would anybody be buying back shares at such high levels, that really the only true your rationale for buying back shares is when they're cheap. But of course, the metric that they're using to justify this is that they are cheap relative to where bond yields are. And because bond yields are so low, then corporate issuance has been very high over the last few years. So a lot of that money has gone into buying back shares and raising dividends. And that has really been an enabler for this market. But of course, the valuation of share buybacks and just how attractive they are is highly dependent on where bond yields are. So what happens to bond yields is likely to be a very important factor in what has been one of the most bullish characteristics for this market. Then the other thing that we've had has been massive issuance of liquidity from central banks. And then it is no exaggeration to say that the impressive rebound that we've had from 2009 till now has been a liquidity-fueled rally, that every time central banks have either stopped adding, and the Fed is by far the most important of those, every time the Fed has stopped adding new money or even taken some out, then the stock markets have pulled back, and when they've started putting the money back in, stock markets went up. In other words, this is a straight inflation deflation story in terms of liquidity. You increase in liquidity, then asset prices increase. And we have ample evidence of that. So then if you look at quantitative easing, and we've been at this service, we've been saying this for quite some time, but one of the things that is beginning to change, it would appear, is that central banks are now coming to the conclusion that quantitative easing is extremely effective at inflating asset prices, namely bonds, equities, and property, but perhaps not so great at encouraging economic growth. So what did we have this week from the Bank of Japan? It was that they decided that they were not going to increase the amount of money that they're allocating to their quantitative easing program. They're just going to keep it the same, but that they're going to concentrate on negative yields. And that's a tacit admittal that just simply increasing the quantity of outstanding yen is not going to achieve the economic growth that they require. And it isn't for Japan in particular. You know, the Fed has a mandate that they have to they have to achieve growth in the economy. And that is not one of the mandates that the ECB has. The ECB's only mandate is to control inflation, and economic growth is left up to the individual states. But for Japan, they absolutely need economic growth because their debt-to-GDP ratio is so high. So they need to stoke inflation, and they need GDP growth because they have an awful lot of debt outstanding, and they can't risk having the cost of rolling over that debt increase without economic growth to fund it. So what we're seeing from them then is this sort of slapdash approach. They're trying everything. And that suggests that we're going to have additional volatility from Japan, that the yen strengthened again in here today, and it was very strong yesterday as well. It was stronger by almost an additional 2 yen in here today, and it's down now to 106. And it really isn't that long ago when the yen was trading closer to 140 to the dollar. So this has been a substantial strengthening of the yen against the dollar. Then, but if you actually look at it over the medium term, then Japan has been one of those central banks that has been increasing the amount of liquidity that it's been pumping into the market for the last 3 years. And it's no longer doing that. And the Fed has hiked rates once already. And they're likely to do so again at some point. But more importantly, they've stopped their quantitative easing program, and they stopped that quantitative easing program nearly 18 months ago. So then you have to look at other central banks. What are they doing in terms of the liquidity that they're adding to the market? And the ECB has also adopted negative deposit rates at the discount window. And we're seeing increasing stories that floating rate mortgage holders are actually getting checks in the mail from their banks because the loans that they took out are actually at now negative yields. So this is an extraordinary set of circumstances. But the most important factor is that central banks now appear to be trying to do something new, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they're adding lots of new liquidity. And when you have prices at where they are right now, then prices are extraordinarily sensitive to liquidity. Well, then the Bank of China is then the next one that really should be considered, because they are continuing to go through this rationalization of their economy, and you cannot simply fire a few million people and not have economic growth to absorb some of those people looking for work. So China then would have to be one of the places where those looking for additional liquidity would have to start pinning their hopes. But it's a closed economy, so a lot of how China will benefit the rest of the world is what it imports. And that isn't something that we've seen a great deal of just yet, but I think what happens in China is going to have quite a considerable influence. Now, when we look at the stock market over the short term, then we've had a very impressive rally from the January low. But before the January low, we pulled back very sharply. And we pulled back very sharply in August. And it's easy to shrug off something like a flash crash. That's exactly what the market did in 2010 in May, when you had the first flash crash. But what it does is it's debilitating to sentiment. And then you have this additional pullback in January, which was the worst start to a year in memory. And then now we've pushed all the way right back up to the highs, but with corporate profits turning over, then that lends people to ask an important question, which is, who's going to be the first person to pay all-time new highs for the S&P or for the NASDAQ? And for every person that says, well, it's not going to be me, there's going to be someone else that says, I think I'm going to take some of my money off the table and let someone else take that risk. And we've certainly seen this kind of rotation going on, where instruments that were deeply oversold are now starting to attract attention, and those that were the real high flyers last year are just getting taken out one by one. So Netflix was also down heavily this week, and that's not least because Amazon is setting its sights on usurping it by offering monthly subscriptions to Prime. Then, well, the short term is that there was an overbought condition evident on the majority of stock markets, and that is now beginning to be unwound. And the S&P hasn't quite unwound its overbought condition just yet, and the Nasdaq has unwound quite a bit more of it. It's been leading on the downside. So there is the potential that we get a little bit of steadying next week. But these indices now have work to do, and the problem for the Nasdaq in particular is that it now has a lower high, and when you look at it over the last year and a half, then we don't generally tend to indulge in nomenclature, but it looks like either a developing type 3 top or a developing head and shoulders top or a developing messy situation. And the only way that we can analyze it is to look at any of these indices that have been going up for much of the last 7 years and ask, are these trends still consistent? And the answer is very simply, no, they're not. That tells us that there's an imbalance between supply and demand that drove those bull markets higher, and it's no longer present. And that isn't a fact that we can just ignore willy-nilly, but rather that we need substantial evidence that there is a new demand story. And with there's a lot of fear out there, and particularly we just do not know exactly what it is that central banks are going to do, because the problem is that they probably don't know themselves. We've never been in this kind of extraordinary situation before. And then the Fed has got substantial quantities of treasuries outstanding that will need to be rolled over at some point in the next 3 to 4 years, because there's upwards of 150 billion this year, and there's another 200 and something billion next year, and there's over 300 billion the year after, and then I think it goes back down to 200 and something billion the year after that. And that's a substantial chunk of treasuries that will need to be issued first and then absorbed. And if the Fed is going to continue to hold the size of its balance sheet steady, and it has been doing that for I think it's about 14 months now. Well, then there's going to have to be a lot of trading. They're going to have to buy a lot of bonds. When they eventually start to sell those bonds, or when the Fed begins to allow the size of its balance sheet to contract, then that's likely to represent the peak in the 35-year bull market for bonds. But right now, if you look at that total return chart, and I've posted it in comment of the day today, that continues to move higher. And it's moving higher in a reasonably consistent manner. And until that really loses consistency and sustains a move below its trend mean, and then breaks to a new low, then we won't have evidence that this, what has been a phenomenal bull market in bonds is over. But then when you think about what are the things that are worth buying, you generally want to buy low and sell high, and it's very difficult to argue that bonds are low right now. In fact, they're at still close to historic low yields. More than $1.5 trillion of debt is trading at negative yields, and against that background, there's no way you could say that they're cheap. But there isn't any evidence that the momentum has been taken out of the market yet either. Then, what are the instruments that are cheap? It's got to be commodities. And commodities came down for 4 years, and the mining sector went through an incredibly painful process of rationalization, and that's now probably over. Particularly because oil prices have rallied, and they're a bit overbought in the short term. So I mean, it's very the big question on everybody's minds is just how high are oil prices likely to go? And they're not far off having doubled off their low already. So this has been an incredibly impressive rally. When we look at it over the medium term, then it's only really a question of at what price does unconventional oil and gas start to become drilling start to become economic again, and when we reach that point and some of these drillers start up their operations again, that's likely to represent a medium-term peak. And as a point that I've been making in the audios for in the Friday audios for a number of years is that oil prices, if you're really looking for a template for what might happen next, then natural gas represents a potential template. Because we had a phenomenal bull market, and then this additional sources of supply came into the market, and prices deteriorate until they become economic, and then they go back up until prices start to become economic again. And that generally has meant that oil, that natural gas has ranged between about $1.50 and $4 for the last 6 or 7 years. So then you've got to think, is that potentially what we're going to have in oil prices? Is the low somewhere just above 25? And is the high somewhere between 50 and 60? And we can't do anything other than guess at the moment. But generally speaking, if you listen to some of the people that are doing the drilling, then they generally say that between $40 and $50 is about where they break even. So they're not likely to make a decision to start up drilling again until they have some evidence that prices can hold above that level. So then the oil price was a little bit softer in here today, but strong just about every other day this week. So we might get a little bit of a pause, but this has been an incredibly consistent advance so far. And the fact that oil prices are rallying is a major enabler for a rally in just about all other commodities, because energy is not only the largest, the most liquid of the commodities, but it's also an enabler for the production and transportation of just about every other commodity. And when oil prices were low, it made some pretty marginal suppliers profitable, or at least able to sustain their operations. And with rising oil prices, then that takes some of the support away from marginal supply of just about everything. And that has been the enabler for the really quite impressive rally that we've had in commodity currencies, in commodities themselves, and in miners. Well, then, you know, one of the things that, you know, we try our best to do is to link various themes together. And when you see this reversionary rally, and now it's better than that, going on in commodities, and it really does look like a recovery situation. Well, there's two things that we can gauge from that. In that, one is that it's being stoked by the move in oil prices, but also because it's one of the only cheap sectors out there. But the other important point is that commodities are not leaders. In fact, generally speaking, it is the basic resources sector that rallies last in a big bull market. And that does appear to be what is now happening. We certainly wouldn't expect commodities to peak ahead of the wider market. In fact, they generally tend to peak well after the wider market. And if you actually look at the way the stock market indices are performing, then they've already peaked. Now, it's already a medium-term peak that's been put in there. And they have a lot of work to do if they're going to break upwards out of these ranges rather than mess around and continue to be very volatile and potentially even break down from these ranges. So then we're already seeing this rally in energy commodities, and that is not wholly different from what we saw in 2007-2008, because it was commodities were going absolutely gangbusters at the beginning of 2008, and everything else was rolling over. So, or at least had paused. And that's something that we've been looking for quite a while now, well over a year, and we're now starting to see some evidence that is in fact happening. So this has been a phenomenal bull, a medium-term bull market, which took the S&P from 666 to in excess of 2100. And we've had a loss of momentum, and that's and this is something that David that you know coined for the chart seminar, and it is that a big congestion area trading range following what had been a consistent advance is seldom a reliable continuation pattern. And that's something that's been rolling around in my head for the last week. And in fact, that was actually why I initiated short positions in both the S&P and the NASDAQ. It was because I think that these congestion area trading ranges are unreliable continuation patterns, and we're at the upper side of those ranges now. So I think you know that the risks have risen in the short term. And then we have to consider, well, what are the medium-term risks? And this is the long-term audio. So markets ranged for a substantial period of time. And you could argue that a number of European indices are still ranging. In fact, the FTSE 100 has been ranging for 16 years. But when we look at Wall Street, and we have a lot of back history for Wall Street, that generally when it ranges for upwards of 15 years and breaks out, then that's the beginning of a new secular bull market. And in 1980, when you had that big breakout, then you had a big breakout and it came back and tested the upper side of the range. And it was at that test of the upper side of the range 2 years later, in 1982, that valuations bottomed. And but that had already been after the big breakout, and it was the stock prices led the valuations. And you know, there's a likelihood that that is what we're going to get here, and particularly when we have margin at very high levels, corporate profits already at historic levels, and debt issuance at historically high levels, that there is potential here that we're going to get you know, all three of those coming down from historically high levels and leading to a kind of a messy environment for the next year or two. And that would allow valuations to contract, and in some cases probably contract a lot. And that really would be the bottom and in terms of the valuations. But it's unlikely to represent the bottom in the stock market. The chances are that the bottom that we saw in early 2009 in stocks was the bottom, and that we're really still in the foothills of a secular bull market. There are enormously exciting things happening out there, not least in the technology sector, but in the energy sector in particular. And the fact that the global population is still expanding, and that governance really is improving all around the world. And you know, even basket case countries like Argentina can begin to get their act together, and that the commodity bull market might have papered over a lot of cracks in governance in Latin America, but Dilma Rousseff is just about being impeached now, and there's the potential. And I think obviously Brazil has got an awfully long way to go, but there is the potential that for things to get better there. And Narendra Modi is still the Prime Minister of India. And Widodo is still the Prime Minister of Indonesia. And when you start adding these countries together, you're talking about a substantial portion of the global population. And population growth in the next 20 to 30 years is going to happen in Africa. And that's where the majority of the additional population is likely to be. And governance is also slowly but surely beginning to improve there. And generally speaking, what you're getting is you get a lot of headlines about just how bad Jacob Zuma is in South Africa and the threat that he represents to the independence of the judiciary more than anything else. I think that is perhaps the most bullish factor that South African governance has. And while that tends to make headlines, you hear nothing of the improving situation that you're getting in Nigeria. And in fairness, Nigeria is probably the country that is most associated with corruption, and yet it is getting better there, and albeit from a very low base. So the governance situation is improving, and the pace of technological innovation continues to accelerate. And certainly there was a lot of good news was priced into the biotech sector last year, and we've had a substantial drawdown, and potentially that drawdown is not yet over. But it isn't from the same kind of valuation that we saw for technology or for media or telecoms or biotech in 1999. Yes, we've had a lot of good news priced in. And there is the potential now that we're going to see some rock bottom valuations for some of these companies. But these have products and a lot of them have earnings. So this is a medium term, you know, corrective phase for the sector, but it's unlikely to be an important top. And it's very much the same case with stock markets generally, that yes, this is a more difficult environment. And because of the extraordinary monetary environment that we find ourselves in, then we just don't exactly know how it's all going to play out. So we have to bear in mind exactly what it is the consistency of the trends are telling us. And short term, there are risks of a drawdown. And medium term, we could be in a very messy environment for another year or two. But long term, then any substantial drawdown is likely to be a buying opportunity because the secular trend is likely to be upwards when you've had such a big breakout from a very clearly defined trading range. And you don't have to look particularly far. If you're going to have 2 billion additional consumers and governance improves to an extent that those consumers are allowed to reach their productive capacity, then that's going to create additional demand for just about everything. And then with technological innovation, not only is technology improving, but the availability of that technology is also being enhanced. And you have to think that it was the in the post-war era, it was the rise of the rebuilding of Europe. And then you had Japan innovating. And in the last decade, you've had China industrializing. And you can see that over time, what's happening is that the availability of technology is getting increasingly wide. And we're getting to a point rather quickly where the availability of technology is going global instantly. And that's going to be a powerful enabler for individual productivity. So not only will we have an additional 2 billion consumers, but that all 8 to 9 billion of us will be more productive as well. And that alone is something that can drive the secular bull market. And then the innovation that we're getting in the energy sector. And we were talking about unconventional oil and gas being a game changer for the energy sector for at least 5 years before prices came down. And that really is in the price now. But what's likely to put a cap on oil prices is that unconventional oil and gas. And it's also the fact that battery technology is finally starting to come good and that you're getting scale brought into the manufacturing sector. And then it is the partnership between solar and batteries that is likely to really start to wean people off of fossil fuels. And that means that the cost of energy goes down. And in basic economics 101 is that when the cost of something goes down, demand goes up. And if demand for energy goes up, that will fuel economic growth. So that's an additional enabler for a secular bull market. And it means that as long as these things are occurring, that what you're actually looking for is for people to get progressively more bearish, because that will be an indication that they've already sold, that people have panicked out of the market. And then that will be a great time to be looking for the kinds of investments that can be held on to, not just for the short term, but for the medium term or even the long term. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you. I should mention that it is a holiday in the UK on Monday, so David won't be here. I think there's a lot happening in the market, so I will be working. I also wrote an article for Money Week magazine, and they described me as their, and that's a UK publication. I think it's the largest UK financial magazine. And they described me as their investment director, and that's because I've agreed to write a a technology newsletter for them. But that does not mean that I'm going to be leaving Fuller Tracy money. My name is on the masthead here, and I'm an equal shareholder in this company, so I'm not going anywhere. I think, you know, David is my mentor and one of my best friends. Our subscribers are like family for us, and we're both 100% dedicated to providing you with the very best service that we can. And I'll be posting the article I wrote next week. So, well, I'll leave you for the weekend, and wish all the best to all of you.